Hello, and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast for The Lancet. Today, Jessamy Baginal, senior editor at The Lancet, talks with Professor Rosanna Peeling of London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine about recent studies looking at the presence of antibodies in populations of countries which have been hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hi, Rosanna. Thanks so much for joining us today. Perhaps you might be able to tell us a little bit about where you're working at the moment and what your kind of role has been in the COVID-19 effort.
Hello. I work at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where I have a chair in diagnostics research. I'm also the director of the International Diagnostics Centre, which is headquartered in London at the London School. But we have members of the centre around the world, in the US, in Africa, Latin America, etc. I'm also on the UK Public Health Rapid Support Team Steering Committee. And with that, we do a lot of work looking at support to not only in the UK, but for WHO and other countries that request support. I also, for COVID, work as a member of the Africa CDC Lab Working Group to help with the capacity building for lab-based testing in Africa way back in February.
Yeah, well, that's an incredible list of activities that you were involved in. And you've kindly agreed to talk to us today a little bit about seroprevalence studies. Perhaps you could just start by telling us what a seroprevalence study is.
A seroprevalence study, sometimes also called a serosurvey, is a study where you use an antibody test to try to determine exposure to a pathogen. And so usually the choice of what antibody you use and the purpose of the seroprevalence study are the most important factors that you need to consider in doing so, because those two aspects of it determines how accurate the serosurvey is.
We've published one study and we're publishing another study from Spain and Geneva, and they're looking at antibodies which they believe are specific for SARS-CoV-2. But how much can be gained from these studies? What are the sort of major strengths and weaknesses of this kind of way of looking at mass infection?
Well, usually we use antibodies to look for exposure. Antibodies are the most sensitive way to be able to document exposure of a person to an infection. And so if we do a seroprevalence, say, in the general population, you will be able to know how many people have had exposure to the virus, and therefore whether you have what we call herd immunity, how many people in the community has been infected currently or in the past. And based on that, you could develop public health measures as well as disease control programs. And so they are very important. And these types of antibody assays could also allow us to look at where are the hotspots if we do them in different geographic locations. And the higher the prevalence, the means that there's been more exposure. So a hotspot means maybe there's something going on there that you need to investigate why there's so much transmission of infection. It could also allow you to identify who are the people most at risk if you're collecting demographic information along with the survey. And in this case for COVID, is the elderly, is those people with underlying conditions. And also, we also determine, unlike Zika, we also determine that children are not specially affected, although now new data is coming out that children are affected in a different way with inflammatory diseases. And so I think that in general, these are very useful studies to do to try to add to our understanding of what a pathogen can do in a population.
And kind of specifically related to COVID-19 and sort of some of the uncertainties that we have around it with regard to, you know, whether we even have immunity after you've contracted the virus, what are some of the sort of major weaknesses or flaws in sera surveys and this way of trying to look at things?
If we read a paper on a sera survey, the first thing we need to do is to see what the purpose of the survey is and whether they've chosen the right antibody assay to do the survey. As you know, the accuracy of antibody assay, the sensitivity and specificity are really related. In an antibody survey, you really need to look at the prevalence, estimated prevalence of the population ahead of choosing your antibody assays in terms of accuracy. Because if you choose an assay that has low specificity, that means this assay could have cross-reactive antibodies, could detect cross-reactive antibodies against other causes of respiratory infections. Or for COVID, it could be that it cross-reacts with the seasonal or common coronaviruses instead of specifically COVID-19. And or other, I think there's been some instance of cross-reaction, for example, with other causes of fever. And so if you choose a test that has low specificity, you're going to get more false positives than real false positives in a low prevalence situation. And so if you choose a test that has low sensitivity, then you're not detecting the people who indeed have antibodies to the assay. And so you will actually have a set of very misleading data on which you would try to determine public health measures. Or if you think that this assay is to indicate that people already have immunity and can return to work or to be able to freely go around without observing any public health measure, those could be very dangerous in terms of prolonging the pandemic.
I mean, both the studies that we have published and are publishing show a kind of seroprevalence of around 5%, so, you know, relatively low. What are the implications of that on, you know, potential future outbreaks, waves of COVID-19?
Well, with low prevalence, what it means is that in that first wave, the pathogen has not reached a lot of people. So 5% would be just infecting 5 out of 100 people. And so you could expect that if there are still reservoirs of the virus in the community, because in the first wave, contact tracing hasn't been done very well, then you could expect if you lift any of the public health measures, such as social distancing, you will expect a big second wave because there are still more susceptibles in the population. And if there are still reservoirs of the virus in the population, as soon as you lift those public health measures, then the virus will start to be transmitted and then you will get a second wave.
And obviously, we've seen a, you know, sort of second outbreak in Beijing recently. But, you know, for the rest of the world, you know, here in the UK, we are loosening restrictions fairly rapidly, relatively. What's the current thinking on a second wave or outbreak in, you know, the UK and Europe? Where do you stand on that?
It's very difficult to say at the moment. I think that in Asia, countries reacted very quickly to the coronavirus outbreak because they had a memory of SARS, where lots of people died. And so they started lockdowns very quickly, etc. And so if there are still viruses in their population, I'm sure that's why we've seen these peaks come up again in Asian cities as soon as they lift the restrictions. In the UK, I think we were slower to put in these lockdowns. And so maybe if we are monitor the situation very closely, we may be able to continue not to have a big second wave, but to be able to have a more flattened, even if we have a second wave, to have a more flattened curve rather than a big spike. Because we want to avoid the big spike at all costs because of we don't want the healthcare system to be overwhelmed, and we wouldn't have enough personnel to be able to do contact tracing thoroughly to be able to contain the spike of infections.
And in the Spanish study that we're about to publish, and also, you know, what we're hearing from Australia is that there's a sort of a large amount of household transmission. What are the implications for how we implement public health measures in the future, for future outbreaks, if we know that household transmission is a kind of major source?
Yeah, so this brings into question the whole issue of staying at home, right? Because at first we were acting mostly on the fact that we thought that everybody who's infected eventually will become symptomatic. But we know now that there are asymptomatic people who could spread the virus, as well as what we call pre-symptomatic people that could be also spreading the virus. So if we identify anybody who's virus positive by a molecular assay, and we ask them to stay home, without any distancing from household members, it means that it's highly likely that household members will get infected. And I think in most places in the world, it's very difficult to have social distancing in a household for a member of the household. And so in some countries, I know from experience in Peru, when they actually had volunteers who would be trained to do these rapid antibody assays, and they are patients, people who are symptomatic could call on a hotline or register on the internet, and the government would send these teams of volunteers who've been trained to do the testing to go to the home and test them so that they don't have to come out to any public place or to a clinic or to a hospital. And then if they anybody tests positive in that household, and they saw that it's not possible for them to self-isolate at home, then they are being sent to a government quarantine facility. And then if they're severely ill, they are sent to the hospital. So that is sort of one way of determining, you know, or trying to stop the spread of household transmission.
And that's kind of like the Fengcheng sort of hospitals that they had in China as well.
Yes.
That kind of concept. So I guess though it's still difficult because of these pre-symptomatic people who you know, may be already infecting household members before they get symptomatic. So it just seems, you know, something, an issue that seems extremely difficult to manage from a public health point of view.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think there was one study that showed that, in fact, about 40% of the transmission in that study took place before people became symptomatic. That has thrown all our sort of normal public health measures into question. And so I think right now for us, that's why, you know, we used to not recommend people wear masks unless they're ill. And now we're saying everybody should wear a mask because we don't know. We can no longer base on who's infected through looking at symptoms. And so just as part of the precautionary measure is for everyone to wear masks so that they are not, as they're speaking or singing or doing anything in a group, to be spreading virus through droplets.
Yeah, thank you. And if I might just ask a question that we were talking about before, you said you were kind of heavily involved in sort of looking at tests and things like that. And I was just wondering whether you might be able to give us some kind of an update on where we are with tests.
Okay, so from very early days of the epidemic, when the virus sequence was first known, lots of companies and research institutions developed molecular testing. And those were all available in the public domain. And companies then made molecular testing kits so that you could buy them without having to make them yourself. And so molecular testing, would be the most sensitive and specific way to confirm that somebody who's ill has infection. And in fact, now we use molecular testing even on asymptomatic contacts of cases in order to see whether they are also infected. So molecular testing is fine. There are now sort of point of care molecular testing where it's, you just have to take the sample, put it into a tube to process and then put it into the machine to read. And it's all automated. It's what we call sample in, answer out type of test. So these usually require a small instrument, but it's very easy to use and can be used in community settings rather than big, expensive labs where not molecular testing is usually done. But still, molecular testing is very, very hard to scale to a community level and to be for nationwide testing. And so we really need a fairly easy test that would detect viral proteins, what we call an antigen test, that would detect viral proteins. And you would take the same swab as you do for a molecular test. And this test could be done, a rapid one could be done in about 30 minutes, and a lab-based one can be done in a couple of hours. And so those would be easier to use in a community setting or even in a clinic. But so far, we don't have, from all the evaluations so far, we don't have a sensitive enough antigen test yet for us to be able to use. The last type of tests that we could use in a pandemic are the antibody tests. And so, as we mentioned, antibody tests are great for seroprevalence studies or serosurveys, but because in a lot of countries, they don't have access to molecular testing and we don't yet have antibody antigen tests that are good enough yet, some countries are in fact using antibody tests to try to identify people who have been infected. And this has, the use of that is a little bit controversial, but when you have no access to testing at all, having an antibody test that you could use to identify if somebody's been recently infected is also useful. I think that what we ideally like at this stage of the pandemic is an antibody assay that could tell us whether we have neutralizing antibodies that could be protective, that this type of antibody response would offer us what we call immunity to the virus, that we're protected from being infected again, or that we are no longer shedding infective virus and therefore not at risk of spreading our infection to anyone. That we do not have yet. What we've seen in a lot of studies is that you could have antibodies to what we know now in the lab as neutralizing antibodies in the lab. They don't seem to, patients with those antibodies still seem to have a lot of virus that we could detect. So we still don't really know what neutralizing antibodies mean. And I don't think we've identified adequately a neutralizing response or protective antibody response that we could use to decide who is it safe to return to work if after you've been infected. And this is especially critical for healthcare workers or essential workers that are in touch, that are in contact with the public. And we want to know whether truck drivers who are who we need to transport food and others everywhere, they should be tested. But is that test good enough to know whether if they've been infected, that return to work? And also, as schools reopen, do we know that we have a safe environment in the schools? And how should we conduct testing among school teachers and school children to know that we're not having a spread of virus in the second wave in schools? So those are still what's difficult. We have quite really accurate antibody assays that we could do in the lab. But unfortunately, right now, those assays require that we take venous blood. And so it means that if you do want to take a large-scale survey, you will have to have teams of people who knows how to take venous blood, which is quite a big drawback as to how you design or carry out sero surveys.
Thank you, Rosanna. That's a great way to end, I think. Sort of a long way to go, it seems.
Yes, I'm afraid so. Yes.
That's really brilliant. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.